Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye.
I'm joined by Anthony Albanese, who is, of course, the Shadow Minister for Infrastructure and also the member for Grandler. Anthony, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And we're here to talk about your book, which is called Albanese Telling It Straight and written by very respected journalist Karen Middleton. Can you first of all tell us how this book came about?
Well, Karen had asked me about doing a biography for a number of years, and I'd always said no, but I think the time was right to tell some of the stories in the book, in particular the story about finding my father in 2009. And Karen, of course, is a well-respected professional journalist, and I knew that she would treat the topic very seriously. She was leaving her job at SBS TV as the Canberra Press Gallery reporter. So it fitted her timetable as well, in that she worked full-time on it for just about the whole of last year. And so in terms of getting the book done and out, it was a long process, but I wanted the story to be told in detail rather than just as a footnote and then have to go back and explain all the detail and fill in the gaps.
Well, you speak a lot in the book, or the book speaks a lot about your mother as being a central influencer in your political career. Tell us about that element of it.
Well, she certainly was. I was raised by just my mother, and a two-person family is pretty special, I think, because you rely upon each other. And my mum was a special person. She had rheumatoid arthritis, an acute condition. So she spent long time in hospital. But she was someone who believed in the power of education and encouraged me to get an education. She had three great faiths, I say. I was raised with the Catholic Church, the Australian Labor Party, and South Sydney Rugby League Football Club.
So it was always the Labor Party back in the early days for you? No other political views?
No, I was raised in a council housing estate in Camperdown in inner Sydney, and I think it's fair to say that it was just part of the culture there that people went to church on Sunday, the Labor Party branch on Monday, and the rugby league on Saturday. That was very much part of the culture. And it being a council house as well, the Labor Party and its activism in the Sydney City Council played a critical role in our lives. And so it was just a natural thing to join the Labor Party, and I joined while I was still at school. It certainly wasn't with any intention of going into Parliament. It was just what you did.
So you became a member of Young Labor. What happened from there? Because obviously that was, I think, what then progressed you through into getting involved more in politics, then leading to you spending two decades plus in Parliament.
Yes, I joined my local Young Labor group, and then I got more active when I got to university, and I was fortunate enough to be elected as the president of New South Wales Young Labor in 1985. And I served two terms as the president, and that was a key organisation. I joined the left of the Labor Party, and in New South Wales that was very much a minority position. But one of the key organisations that the left were a majority in was Young Labor. So having that responsibility was a key role in the whole of the New South Wales branch, and that led to me to have contacts right around branches around New South Wales, and I became the Young Labor's sole representative to the ALP National Conference back in 1986. So I got to negotiate policy positions, including making what is now Triple J a national youth radio station. That was a direct result of a motion that I moved on the floor of that national conference, having negotiated with the senior members of what was then the Hawke government. So I picked up some skills, and that led me to then be elected as the Assistant State Secretary of the Labor Party in New South Wales. I'd been working for Tommy Wren, who was a great mentor, of course, a former prisoner of war of the Japanese, a former deputy leader of the Labor Party, and a great fighter for causes such as peace and disarmament and the protection of our natural environment.
Now, in the Young Labor movement, and of course right throughout Labor, there's the factional system. I've got a few friends in Young Labor, and they're always talking about that. So how would you describe that sort of atmosphere to an outsider? You mentioned there that you're part of the left.
Yes, well, it was the left were a majority in New South Wales and nationally. So it taught you to, I guess, negotiate through the processes of the party. Any organisation, of course, has factions, whether they're formalised or not. And that, I guess, being in a leadership position, you have to also reach out beyond just your factional position. But you learn how to debate, how to organise, how to lobby for support. And that, I think, puts you in good good stead to move on to the Australian Labor Party senior organisations. And I certainly picked up skills in Young Labor. It happened that the time that I was president, there was an attempt by the more conservative grouping in the party to take over Young Labor. So that meant there was a real focus on organising up to the annual conference. And that necessary skill that in politics helps at every level of being able to try to convince someone to vote for you and to, in terms of to elected positions, but also to try and persuade someone of your policy position is something that continues right up to today, where I've had meetings this week with members of the crossbenches in the Senate trying to convince them to vote consistent with Labor's position on issues such as the backpacker tax and opposing the passenger movement charge that the government wants to bring in on tourists.
What were some of your key values or beliefs or stances on policies that made you part of the left? I guess what separated you from some of your more conservative colleagues in your own party?
Well, at the time, I always had a very strong position on the environment, and that is now a mainstream position in the Labor Party. I think one of the things that characterises progressive views in the party is that views that were once held solely by the left, there's now common interest on. I was very interested in international issues in particular. I was active in the anti-apartheid movement and supporting the African National Congress representative in Australia at the time, Eddie Fundy, who was arguing the case strongly. I think that for my generation, the struggle of Nelson Mandela and the ANC was quite inspirational. And that became very much a mainstream Labor movement issue as well. But I think the issues of government intervention, I was a strong supporter of a preparedness of Labor governments to support the public sector And those issues were, at the time, controversial within the Labor Party. The issue of the privatisation of the Commonwealth Bank was something that, at the time, I opposed, and that was consistent with the left's position.
Now, you're the member for Grayndler, of course, in New South Wales. How did that come about? And also, can you describe what that area of Sydney is like? What are the demographics?
Yeah, Grayndler is an inner west electorate. It's just one removed from the inner city. So it's very much an area in transition. It's one that traditionally was a blue-collar working class area, with large micro communities, Italians in Leichhardt, Portuguese in Petersham, and Greeks in Marrickville. But now that is very much in transition. People have come into the area who are professional. There's a lot of young people in the area. It's close to Sydney University, and it's an area that's very vibrant. So you still have the multicultural mix, but you have a vibrant live music scene. You have quite a number of young people, and it's a very political area. It's very progressive. There's a substantial presence of every movement possible, with regard to local community-based organisations. And when there are festivals held, for example, there's every cause possible comes through. So it's an area that people are very active in politics, and it means that a campaign in an electorate like mine is very spirited. There's a bit of a focus on it at the last election. My Greens political party opponent put in substantial resources, would have spent in excess of $500,000 on my estimate of on the campaign in order to try and secure that seat. But fortunately, I had a very good result in July and was re-elected to Parliament, and that's a responsibility that I take very seriously indeed.
Well, that was sort of my next question, because both you and Tanya Plibersek, of course, in the electorate of Sydney, were said to be under threat potentially from Greens candidates, but that doesn't seem to have taken hold, whereas here in Melbourne, in Victoria, in electorates similar to yours, like Batman and Wills, the Green vote seems to be higher. Do you put that down to any particular factor?
Well, I think Tanya and myself have been long-term members, and I think that people know what we stand for. We are both progressive members of Parliament, and in my case, in the election, I think there was some frustration from members of the community who were asking themselves, why is Richard Di Natale on numerous visits, Adam Bandt, why the Greens had billboards everywhere in my electorate trying to depose me, but very little effort in a marginal seat just next door, for example, the seat of Reid, which the replacement of the Liberal member for Reid with a Labor member would increase the chances of there being a Labor government formed. And I think there was some backlash, certainly in Sydney, against what was seen to be a sectarian campaign. And people took the view that we won't have a more progressive parliament if people like myself and Tanya Plibersek aren't in it.
How do you differentiate yourself from the Greens? Because this seems to be a bit of an ongoing question going forward, particularly in those sorts of inner city electorates. And I speak to a few people from the Labor Party, and some say, no, the Greens are economic vandals, whereas other people on the more left side of the party say that we should do some sort of deal or stop fighting each other in the same sorts of target areas.
Well, I think the difference is that, and one of the things that I stated was that by having myself in the parliament, I seek to make decisions around the cabinet table. That's how you change society in our parliamentary system. Of course, that requires support outside of the parliament. It doesn't just occur through legislation in isolation from what is going on in the community. But the fact is that in terms of those seeking parliamentary representation, I'd rather be around the cabinet table making a decision than waiting until a decision is made and then holding a protest against it. Mm-hmm. And I think people understood that, which is why, as a senior member of the Labor Party and a member now of the Shadow Cabinet, but I would have been a senior cabinet minister had we been elected to government. I think people understood that, and that they wanted to be represented by someone who was making decisions and making a real difference.
Now, the book obviously goes through a bit of the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd leadership spills, and the blurb describes it as a turbulent time in politics. How would you describe that era?
Well, it certainly was turbulent. The book outlines my position, which hasn't changed from the night of 23rd of June 2010, which is that when you replace a first-term elected Prime Minister without there being any warning of that or debate about that in any substantial sense in the community, then it's not surprising that you then find it difficult to put your case at the subsequent election. And that's precisely what happened. I believe we would have been returned a majority government had that not occurred, and that Julia Gillard was the natural successor to Kevin Rudd, and that change would have occurred down the track at some point in time. But I don't think the Australian people were prepared for that change, and they marked us down because of it, and of course it then led to a period of instability. But in spite of that, as I also outline in the book, I believe that both the Rudd government and the Gillard government will be regarded very well by history. In spite of the fact that we were a minority government, we instituted major reforms under Julia Gillard, such as the Gonski reforms, the National Disability Insurance Scheme. We continued to roll out infrastructure investments, including the Regional Rail Link and other projects. And it was a very positive period in which we didn't lose a vote on the floor of the House of Representatives, despite only having 70 members out of 150. The current government, of course, we lasted 3 years without losing a vote. They couldn't last 3 days without losing a vote, and they begin with 76. So I think, particularly by comparison, the Rudd and Gillard governments will stand the test of time, the Rudd government in particular, with saving Australia from the global financial crisis, with what is widely regarded internationally as the world's best economic stimulus plan that was rolled out in 2008-09.
Do you look on at what's going on in the government currently, where obviously there's been a leadership change over a year ago, but still perhaps rumblings of instability and poor performance in the polls? Do you look on at that and say, well, we've already been through this and that we've learnt our lesson?
Well, I think, as I said at the time, when Tony Abbott was replaced by Malcolm Turnbull, I've seen this movie and I know how it ends. Mm. You can't undertake knocking off a first-term elected Prime Minister and expect that things will just return to normal the next day. And what we're seeing here is that Malcolm Turnbull gave up everything that he stands for in order to secure the prime ministership. And now he's like the dog that caught the car. He doesn't know what to do with it. He has positions now on marriage equality, on climate change, on public transport, on a range of issues that are contrary to positions he's held for decades. And I think that's quite sad, because the Australian people had high hopes for Malcolm Turnbull, but they've been disappointed.
Can you talk about the reunion with your father, to change topics, which the book does touch on?
Yes, well, I when I was born, I was told by my mother and my family, and it was just a given that my father had died in a car accident just before I was born. And what I was told by my mother, when she thought I was old enough to understand it, was that, in fact, my mother had travelled overseas, met my father, become pregnant to him. He was betrothed to someone from the town in Italy where he was from. And hence, she came home to Australia. Now, in 1963, it was very difficult for a young Catholic woman to have a child out of wedlock. So in order to preserve the respectability of the family, I was to be adopted out. Now, when I was born, that didn't happen. My mother wanted to keep me, and hence she adopted my father's name. And people were told that my father had been killed. So I thought, for all intensive purposes, I was the son of a widow. But once I was old enough, about 14 or 15, she told me the story. I wasn't interested at that time in searching for him. But as I got older, you get a sense of the need to understand your identity and where you're from, and particularly going into public life with a name like Albanese. The Italian community would ask where he was from, and would ask details about my background. And my mother died in 2002. My son was born in 2000, and there was a particular day when we were at the cemetery visiting my mother's grave, and he said to me, "Where's your daddy?" This is when he was 4 or 5, and it struck me then that I had a responsibility to him as well. Given he had the surname Albanese, to be able to tell him something a bit more than I don't know. So I searched for my father, and through a series of luck, really, through the record from the ship on which he worked, we found an address was found by someone in a box in a warehouse in Genoa. The company SIPMAR had since been disbanded, taken over by P&O, that had been taken over by Carnival. And so we found an address, and there was one day when I got a call. I was about to chair a transport ministers conference, and I had a phone call from Anne Sherry, the head of Carnival, who said, "We've found him." And from that moment, I knew that we had to meet, and I got to meet him in December of 2009. And then I travelled back to Italy, Puglia, which is down in the south, the heel of Italy, travelled back with my son, and then subsequently with my son and my wife, and met the family, including I have a brother and a sister over there, as well as nephews and nieces and other relatives. And they were very welcoming. And it was quite remarkable to, in my late 40s, to discover this new family that I never really knew I had.
And almost the final question, what does the future hold for Anthony Albanese? You seem to be someone that has respect from both sides of politics, and I notice that you often go on some of the more hostile media outlets. So do you have any leadership ambitions? Where do you see the future going?
Well, I ran for the leadership in 2013 and received substantial support for that. But since then, I've got on with the jobs in which I've been given as part of the team. I think the team is more important than any individual, and I've been very much satisfied with that, and I intend to continue to do the job that I have as a Shadow Minister in the best way possible.
And final question, what sort of people do you think would enjoy the book? Who are you pitching it at?
Well, I think it's a book that would appeal to political people, but also it's a bit of a story just about Australia and the times, particularly of growing up in the 1960s and 70s in inner Sydney as a young person in a Catholic family. I think it's a story a lot about my mother as much as it's about me. And a lot of it isn't. It's not a heavy political book or ideological book. And I know that many people of different political views have written to me and have really enjoyed the book. And I think that's great.
Well, Anthony, congratulations on the book. And thank you very much for spending some time with us today and giving us some wonderful insights.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.